Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and he's an internationally recognized expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, and she's an expert in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed and Francine welcome Dr. Gary Friedlander. Dr. Friedlander is the Wayne O. Southwick Professor of Orthopedics at Yale School of Medicine and an expert in the treatment of sarcoma.
Why don't we start off by discussing what sarcoma is, because I suspect many people out there listening may not have a real good sense of what type of cancer that refers to.
Ed, it is a type of cancer, and cancers in general are broken down into two broad categories. One are the carcinomas, those malignancies of epithelial cells, cell surfaces of organs and organ systems in the skin. What we're talking about with sarcomas are cancers of support tissues, connective tissues, bone, cartilage, muscle, and some of the tissues that are in these support organs or tissues, like blood vessels and nerves.
And then there's also, I guess, soft tissue sarcomas and non-soft tissue sarcomas. And how do you break down those two groupings?
We usually refer to bone in and of itself and softer tissues. Cartilage gets caught a little bit in between. But there's bone on one end of that spectrum. And then there are tissues like fat and muscle, the softer tissues, if you will, on the other end. And we call those soft tissue sarcomas.
So, Gary, can you tell us a little bit about how common these types of sarcomas are?
Glad to, Francine. They're uncommon in general. About 1% of the overall cancer population. For myself, they're the things that I deal with every day, and that's what happens when you become a subspecialist and part of a team like we have here at Yale. So these are things I see all the time, but really are only about 1% of the pool of cancers in general.
And what ages do they occur in? Are they common in children, and do they occur in older adults as well?
Yes, an important question. They're actually tumors that happen at all ages, but the specific kind of sarcoma one finds in children is different than the specific kinds of sarcomas of older individuals. And as an example, retinoblastomas or some of the muscle tumors, rhabdomyosarcomas, are more common in very young children. Ewing sarcoma, osteosarcomas occur in later childhood, young adulthood, and then we see some of the fibrosarcomas and chondrosarcomas more commonly in older age.
And there are also sarcomas that can involve the GI tract as well. Is that correct? Or
I'm an orthopedic surgeon, so I'm aware of that. I don't take care of them as much, but indeed, they are the most common sarcomas. There are less than 10,000 sarcomas occurring each year in the United States, of which a third are GI tract.
So we talk about low-grade and high-grade sarcomas, and I wonder if you could tell us, are there sarcomas that are not truly malignant tumors, and is there a spectrum in terms of the behavior of these tumors?
It's a very important question, and the answer is yes, there is a spectrum. The spectrum starts on one end with benign, and on the other end with what we term high-grade. There are intermediate stops between those two extremes that are generally termed low grade and intermediate grade. Treatment, on the other hand, tends to be either focused on benign and low grade or on the higher grades. And so when you find tumors in between, intermediate, you have to choose whether to, if you will, overtreat or undertreat. And by convention, we overtreat, if you will. We lump them with the high grade. So, yes. And the treatment is different between a benign and a low-grade cancer and an intermediate or high-grade cancer on the other end.
It seems funny to use the terms benign and tumor or benign and cancer in the same breath. So these benign sarcomas or lesions, are they really tumors? Are they really cancer?
Well, I tried to... First of all, well, let me back up a moment. The word tumor to me represents a lump, and you can have a benign tumor or a malignant tumor. I think in common parlance, when you begin to use the word tumor, it often conjures up the notion of something nasty. And I think it's important as we talk to each other and as we talk to patients to define the terms. And I find myself doing this regularly with patients, almost apologizing sometimes for using the word tumor when I mean potentially benign. So your point is well taken, and we should start out with the definitions. And if I use the word tumor, I should let you know if I'm talking about a benign tumor or a malignant tumor. There are no benign malignant tumors. That's incongruous. What makes a tumor malignant is its ability to metastasize. And once it gains that potential, it is a malignancy. Now, that potential may be low or high, and consequently, our classification of low-grade malignancies, but still able to metastasize, versus high-grade malignancies. We are sometimes caught in the dilemma of conventions that have classified a tumor as a low-grade malignancy despite its inability to metastasize. So the terms get fuzzy sometimes, but just trying to keep things relatively simplistic, malignant means it can spread, benign means it can't.
And Gary, what do we know about the risk factors that are commonly associated with the development of, you know, sarcomas, and also maybe as part of that, is there any genetic component to the risk factors?
Absolutely. And I think if I were to point to an area of progress, it's our understanding of why these tumors happen under certain circumstances. It used to be very easy to say, I don't know. We just haven't figured it out yet. And for a large number of tumors, we don't know. But we do have increasing information about risk factors. For example, irradiation, something we use to treat tumors, can in and of itself at higher doses cause new tumors to happen years later. We know that certain chemicals in our workplace and chemicals in our homes can cause cancer. Certain pesticides, certain herbicides, certain chemicals like arsenic that are used in industry and in preparing fabrics, we know now can cause cancer. Chronic lymphedema, a circumstance that happens when we interrupt the lymph drainage, the classic example being in mastectomies, the circumstance of chronic edema seems to lend itself towards the formation of some cancers. We know there are individuals, families that genetically seem predisposed to have multiple malignancies. So there is a genetic or hereditary component. There are malignancies associated with HIV infection, Kaposi sarcomas. Not a simple answer, but what we're finding is there are multiple pathways to get to this same endpoint, cancer.
So Gary, there are a lot of patients out there now that have been treated with radiation, patients with prostate cancer, breast cancer, Hodgkin's disease, for instance, that are long-term survivors. So to what degree do these people have to worry about sarcomas, and how frequently do sarcomas occur in patients who are long-term survivors of radiation, of therapeutic radiation?
It's a small but important number, and not, I would hope, cause for great alarm in individuals. What it does tell me, these small numbers, is that people just need to remain vigilant. They need to remain under the care of people that can help monitor whether or not one of these late sarcomas is developing.
And are there any symptoms that you would typically look out for that might suggest that a lump or a bump, in the arms or legs might be something more serious?
Yes, the symptoms of a sarcoma are either pain or a lump or both. And malignancies tend to grow, and they tend to be deeper in the body rather than just underneath the skin. The most common lump is a harmless fatty tumor underneath the skin, and if it's less than 2 inches, it almost never is malignant. I've given up saying always and never, but there are some guidelines, and a lump that is growing, I think, deserves some additional attention, and a healthcare professional should be able to guide you as to whether further studies are important to clarify what's going on.
So when we're talking about imaging studies, we have PET scans, MRIs, and CAT scans. Can you tell us a little bit about how each one of those is used in the diagnosis and follow-up of patients with sarcomas?
Yes, Francine. And what I'd like to do is just back up a half step, because those are part of the tools that their physician is going to use to help clarify what's going on, beginning with a good discussion, history, and a physical examination, which often can clarify whether or not something is in need of more evaluation. Then you get into plain x-rays, which are very helpful for bone and are not as helpful for things that happen in the soft tissues. CAT scans and MRIs are extremely valuable imaging opportunities that help us see the inside of the body very clearly and can see the soft tissues. A CT scan sees bone very well. An MRI does not see bone at all, but it sees the things around bone, and so they're complementary. An MRI also helps us know a little bit about the biology more than a CAT scan. An MRI does not involve any radiation. A CAT scan is based on radiation. An MRI, you put yourself in a tube that's surrounded by a magnet. That magnet gets turned on and makes a huge amount of racket. But what it's doing is it's pulling the electrons in each molecule a little bit. They turn off that magnet and everything goes back where it belongs, but sends out a little blip of energy that the computer then picks up in three dimension. We then ask the computer to pretend we're looking at a person from the front, from the side, or literally making slices through them. And by assigning some arbitrary colors to different tissue types, we can sort out both anatomy and biology or physiology. Very, very powerful. PET scan also is very special, along with bone scans, and there are a number of tools that are probably worth mentioning. But the PET scan in particular helps us look at the metabolism of individual cells. And the metabolism of cancer is often different than the metabolism of normal cells. So it is a study that looks at us from head to toe. An MRI is a study that has to be focused on a small area.
And if there is a suspicious lesion that's identified on either CT scan or MRI, what would be the next step, Gary, in terms of the workup process?
Putting all the information together is very important, but ultimately the decision often comes, or the answer, if you will, from a biopsy. Deciding when to do a biopsy and how to do a biopsy is critical, and that's part of a team decision very often, but the surgeon and the radiologist play the very central roles. For example, there are needle biopsies where with some Novocaine and a very special needle, you can get a small piece of a lump or bump, even if it's deep within the body, using a CAT scan machine to guide you or an ultrasound machine to specifically target even a small lump. The advantage is it's not an operation. The disadvantage is it gets a very small amount of tissue, and you need very skilled pathologists, the people who look at these samples, to help interpret them. About 90% of the time, a needle biopsy is very sufficient. The other alternative is termed an open biopsy, where in the operating room, more often than not, although in some offices, but in the operating room generally, you make a modest incision and take a representative portion of the lump to look at under the microscope. And that generally gives us the answer in 99 point something percent of the time.
Thank you, Gary. We'd like to talk a little bit more about the treatment for sarcomas when we come back after this break. You're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we're here today with Dr. Gary Friedlander.
Over 170,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer this year, and more than 85% of these diagnoses are related to smoking. The important thing to understand is that quitting, even after decades of use, can significantly reduce your risk of developing lung cancer. Now, everyday patients with lung cancer are surviving thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care, and new treatment options are giving lung cancer survivors new hope. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer, and patients enrolled in these trials are given access to medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm here with Dr. Ed Chu and Dr. Gary Friedlander discussing sarcomas. So, Gary, we talked a little bit about the diagnosis of sarcoma. Can you tell us what happens next after you have a definitive diagnosis?
Yes, and I can't help but reminisce a little bit. When I first became involved with bone tumors as a resident, and you can't see me on the radio, but that was a while ago, the success rate was rather bleak. And indeed, for an osteosarcoma, the survival rate for 2 years was about 10 to 15%. Very miserable. Today, the survival rate, the cure rate, not just the two-year survival rate, the cure rate is probably around 80%. And the difference is a reflection of the team that gets pulled together to take care of these individuals and the tools that each of those members has to make a difference. And some parts of those are diagnostic with the radiologist and pathologist. Some of them are interventional by surgeons, sometimes irradiation, and often chemotherapy.
So do all patients require an amputation?
Not at all. And in fact, one of the very gratifying changes over these years has been our opportunities as surgeons, parenthetically, because you as chemotherapists have been able to deal with systemic disease better, but we can now isolate the part of the body that has a tumor, be that bone or muscle, and remove just the part that has the tumor, and then use some very creative opportunities to reconstruct the skeleton.
Gary, at Yale, you lead the multidisciplinary team that focuses on sarcoma. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit more about the specific players who make up that team-based approach.
Absolutely. And with our new SMILO Center and our additional leadership, this is a very exciting time to bring these people together in a more formal way and perhaps even a bit more efficient. But I can tell you, as of right now, it's superb. And it involves a patient seeking out help, sometimes for me as a surgeon, sometimes you as a medical oncologist, but most often going to their primary care physician and saying, it hurts, I feel a lump. And then they get referred into our system. And it's each of our jobs to call the team together, depending on what we think the patient's needs might be. Early on, again, the radiologist, absolutely critical. The radiologist I work with sits 15 feet away from me while I'm seeing patients, and the partnership is enormously important and effective, helping me interpret what I see helping me decide what additional tests to get. Then the biopsy, if necessary, and the pathologist becomes the center of attention. We have a diagnosis, and it's always important to know what you're dealing with because that determines what the alternatives are. And there are always choices. And that's when I, as the surgeon, you two, as the medical oncologist, our colleagues in radiation therapy, get together as we do formally and informally. We see each other in the hallways, we see each other in conferences, whatever it takes to make sure this patient has the benefit of all those opinions, and we come to a consensus. And the consensus may include, again, surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, one, all, sequencing those. And then we shouldn't lose the fact of all of the support people that go along with the social aspects or the psychological aspects of people that have these disorders and the pain management that they deserve. Getting people rehabilitated by body, by mind, occupational therapists, physical therapists, psychologists, pain management specialists, all are part of the team.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the advances with respect to helping you to rebuild, say, a bone or a muscle or tissue that you have to excise?
Certainly. Let me focus on bone for a moment. And picture, if you will, that the tumor is in the lower half of the thigh bone, just above the knee. The first step is to remove the lower half of the thigh bone or femur. And then there are choices about how to reconstruct it. And they fall into two general categories. One is a bone from another person, a donor, someone who's passed away. Some generous person or family, just like we have the ability to transplant hearts, lungs, livers, kidneys, corneas. We also have the availability of large segments of the skeleton in a similar way to replace a similar part of our anatomy. And there are some advantages and disadvantages to that approach. And the other option are the metals and plastics that we're so familiar with joint replacements, total hip replacements, total knee replacements that have allowed us to build upon those concepts and replace large portions of the skeleton with metal and plastic.
Are there any long-term complications, Gary, with using these metal prostheses or joint replacements?
There are issues in sometimes the short run, but most commonly the longer run, in that you have to bind them or bond them to the skeleton. You have to insert a stem or some other mechanism to bind these, often by bone cement, to the skeleton. And over a long period of time, that bond can deteriorate in a regular total hip replacement or total knee replacement, we really think in terms of 15, 20, 25 years of good outcome, excellent bond, no need to change. In these larger, we call them megaprostheses, that bond also breaks down over time, but probably doesn't last quite as long. The good news, if you will, is that when these bonds wear, they can be replaced. And I can tell you the 2009 model has been better than the 1999 model, and I have every reason to believe in the future we're going to get better and better.
Is there any good way, in terms of imaging or some other kind of test where you can figure out who is going to have troubles with the bonds breaking down, or then it's just a matter of the patient comes back for follow-up and says there's pain, discomfort, and I just can't do the same kinds of things that I was able to do previously?
These patients become very important to us as physicians, as you know, and we wind up seeing each other over a very long period of time. Part of of the practice I enjoy. Most of these patients we can help dramatically, and we get to know them as they go through life. But periodically, it's our responsibility to make sure they're healthy. And they come back for their 1,000-mile checkups. And as part of that evaluation, part of that evaluation includes making sure that their prosthetic device is in good shape, if you will. And it's a combination of x-ray, plain x-ray generally, and symptoms, that is pain, that allow us to determine how healthy that bond is. And as it deteriorates, you come to mutual decisions about how to address it, which is usually to replace it and start the clock all over again so they can enjoy school, play, work, enjoy their life as usual.
So, Gary, we talked a little bit about the use of chemotherapy in the management of sarcomas, and I wonder if you could comment on some more investigational approaches like isolated limb perfusion or hyperthermia, and whether these actually play a role nowadays in our treatment algorithm for patients.
Yes, thank you for the question. I would just, in terms of context, set out the fact that cancer has two parts to it. One is where it begins. We call that the primary tumor. I, as a surgeon, usually and the radiation therapist usually have responsibility for the primary. But what makes cancer dangerous, as we talked about earlier, is its ability to spread. And until we found ways to deal with the rest of the body and the potential spread through chemotherapy, and in particular multi-drug chemotherapy, we didn't make the dramatic success rates that we enjoy today and set the stage for even better tomorrow. Now, the way we give the chemotherapy can be targeted at the primary tumor as well, and we can deliver some of these drugs directly into the tumor, the primary tumor that we see, by inducing putting a catheter into a blood vessel that feeds them, limb perfusion techniques. And we found in certain types of tumors that's been extremely helpful.
Any new developments from your program in terms of bone research? Because I know that's been an area of interest, your specific interest.
Yes, absolutely. We've found in our parallel lives, thinking about the skeleton, many ways to control the way bone repairs itself. Bone regenerates. So, to me, it's marvelous. Whether you're sitting there or fractured your bone or have a bone graft, there's a process of cells that get together and replace old bone with new bone. And we now have isolated many of the molecules that turn on the process of making new bone. And this, I believe, is going to play a very important role in improving the reconstructions that we're already doing.
Great. Well, we look forward to hearing more about what's going on in that area of research from you in a future show. You've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we'd like to thank our guest expert for this evening's show, Dr. Gary Friedlander, for joining us. Until next time, I'm Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.